Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. With us this week is our star, Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, otherwise known as NYPIRG. He's back again, and we love it every time he's here. We'd have him on every week if we could. Welcome, Blair.
I'm blushing, Alan. Thank you.
Well, you should be. And I hope you will send my comments to family, because that's where it really counts. Okay, let's talk about early voting. Record numbers are out there. Already one half of the number of people who voted in 2016, according to the AP. State election officials have said over 710,000 New Yorkers had voted at in-person polling stations Saturday through Monday, including nearly 400,000 in New York City. What do you think? What do you make of it?
Well, I'm frankly surprised at the voter turnout so far on early voting. I mean, New Yorkers don't have this sort of the muscle memory of early voting. It's really been a phenomenon for the rest of the country. This is the first presidential election that early voting's occurred, and only the second election. So I think it's great. It shows voter enthusiasm. It shows knowledge of the process. The problem that we've seen is the lines have been so long in certain areas of the state. Well, actually, it's been all across the state, but pockets within various regions, that can only be explained by the lack of resources and the failure to plan on the part of the State Board of Elections and the Cuomo administration to pull these elections off. But, I mean, I think it's representative of a widespread concern about on New Yorkers' parts about who they want to support for the election of 2020.
Well, you know, there are two people at our place here at WAMC who teach college classes. And they both have questioned their students whether they're voting or not. The first one, Joe Donahue, said that 23 out of 25 students one day said they had already voted. Isn't that extraordinary?
Yes, that's amazing. I mean, if you look at the history of college voting, that age group voting since 1972, which is the first presidential election where 18-year-olds had the right to vote, they've always lagged behind their older adult counterparts. But there's a lot of enthusiasm. I mean, we work closely with college students. In fact, we run a helpline on election day, and we've been doing some stuff on early voting to assist young voters with the process. And there's a lot of enthusiasm among the Gen Z millennial group.
And the second person is the very producer of this program, David Gastina, who announced that while it wasn't as dramatic as in Joe's class, there were still some who were saying, it doesn't matter. That's the way it is.
Yeah, well, a lot of Americans feel that way and are disenchanted. But generally speaking, you would think that classes taught by WAMC-affiliated staff would have a pretty high level of civic knowledge and want to participate. So I guess it's really a competition between Dave and Joe now.
Or at very least, wanting to please the professor by sometimes not always telling the straight. Okay, so we do know, and I'm quite concerned, that the president says that this election is going to be rigged, and it's especially going to be rigged if he loses. So, Blair Horner, you're a man I have great respect for. You've seen it all. I think I've seen a lot. But I'm scared to death he's going to try to rob this election. I asked the governor about it, and the governor agreed. In the United States of America, in this year, is it possible that's going to happen?
Well, yes, is the short answer. There is a strategy. I mean, it appears pretty clear that the president will not win re-election based on the popular vote. He didn't last time. He lost by millions of votes, and yet because of this sort of anachronistic system of the Electoral College in the United States, he was able to still become president of the United States. And so there's some version of that strategy is what he's trying to employ, and it also it's pretty clear the Democrats outvote Republicans on mail-in voting. And so he's really targeting that audience to see if he can knock out as many what he perceives to be Democratic votes as possible in order to give him the slim margin he needs in each state of his states, of the red states that he took in 2016, to swing toward him again. The math doesn't quite work out that way for him. And so there's, you know, there is this sort of nightmare scenario in which the Electoral College delegates are not able to sit by December 14th to choose the winner in each of the states. And then it may get end up thrown to the House, where it's not a House majority vote. It's the number of states. Each delegation gets one vote per state. And so there's a path there, which is a nightmare scenario, because it shows once again, if that happened, that the popular sentiment of the country would be ignored. And I just think that that's combustible. It's terrible what the president's doing in terms of eroding public confidence in democratic institutions. And if it ends up that he becomes president, or for that matter, Joe Biden becomes president, in a way that it runs afoul of how Americans view their own democracy, I think we're in for a very rough time.
You know so much about government, and the one scenario that I'm worried about really the most is Florida. Now, you're a New York State expert, but I know you read and you have a sense of it. The question is, how much can a governor, a Republican governor, a slavish Trumper, and his Secretary of State influence an election?
Well, I mean, we saw it in 2000, where they did everything humanly possible to jam up votes to effectively elect George Bush at the expense of Al Gore. And, you know, it's possible, because there is latitude given to election officials to determine whose votes get counted and whose don't, particularly when they're non-machine votes, paper ballots, affidavit ballots, whatever. You've seen it even with the U.S. Supreme Court now, where they basically ruled in a recent case to block a state from counting mail-in ballots that come in after Election Day, even if they were postmarked by Election Day. And there's a number of states, as I think the majority of the country, that allows that practice. So there's all sorts of games that can be played when you have elections run by political appointees, or like in New York, the major political parties. These should be run really by independent, civil service protected, sworn to the public interest, well-financed bureaucracies, because it's the bedrock of how the country operates. And the way we run elections in the United States, certainly in New York, but in the United States, is really the equivalent of what a third-rate country does around the world. We have to do much better, and it calls for really a major overhaul.
Now, talking about fraud, the president has basically put out a, well, what could be called a dog whistle, encouraging his supporters to be poll watchers, in quotes. Are you worried about that?
Yeah. I mean, we've seen that even in New York, where thugs wander up and down the lines, particularly targeting college students, scaring them about the act of voting in the wrong place as a felony, scaring young people off or jamming up the lines so that the lines are even longer than necessary. We've seen it happen in New York. There's a recent court case, forget which state, but where a judge ruled that you can carry a weapon into the voting place, the polling place. And all those kinds of things intimidate voters. There's a strategy by the president. It starts with lying about fraud, which is what he's doing. He knows better. He lies. Then compounded with court decisions that make it harder for mail-in ballots to get counted, for the president and his allies to challenge mail-in ballots, and then to encourage thuggery at the polling places, which are all elements to reduce voter turnout. Because again, the path to victory for the Trump administration is one that relies on a minority popular vote, but an Electoral College victory. And that is it's a serious problem. Now, again, I don't mean this in a partisan way. I mean, Democrats are sinners in this area, too. In New York, you should see what happens in New York City. They're just depressing new voter turnout. But a scale is dramatically different in what the president is up to.
This is a rhetorical question to get you to say it. Why are they suppressing new voter turnout?
Well, incumbents get elected based on who votes. And if new voters come in, you don't really know what's going to happen. You can ask former Congressman Joe Crowley about that in New York City. And new voters are an element of unknown for incumbents. Incumbents want their voters to show up because they know the last time that happened, they got elected.
Yes, that's exactly right, I'm sure. However, the Democrats now have a governor and two houses of the legislature. assuming they keep the Senate, which is the one that would be more in play than the Assembly, obviously, assuming that, and they go into session, if they ever go into session because of the COVID and all, will there be an appetite? And you have your ear close to the ground. They've already run out some of the third parties, or trying to run out some of the third parties. Will there be an appetite for reform?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question. I mean, any path in New York State to reform runs through the legislature and the governor. And they're going to be looking out for the interests of the political parties that help elect them, as well as the public interest. So I think it's going to be tough, because the setup in New York is really based in the state constitution. So to change that, you have to change the state constitution. There may be other measures that can be done short of that to reform the system. And I think there'll be a robust debate. I know, because legislators have already called me. The mayor of the city of New York yesterday stood online for 2.5 hours. And at the end of it, when he voted, he said there has to be an overhaul of how elections are run in New York. So I think there's a lot of interest in doing it. Whether or not that interest is enough to throw off the power of the political parties overseeing elections in New York, I think that's the big question. And I mean, the governor is the de facto control of the Democratic Party. If he's interested, then I think we have a good shot. And so far, I think the governor hasn't shown his hand on that. He's focused his criticisms on the New York City Board of Elections, which I think they deserve, of course. But the problem with elections in New York is a statewide problem. It's not just a New York City problem.
So we touched on it just briefly there, but the governor, probably angry, I can't get inside anybody's head, probably angry at the Working Families Party because they put up somebody against them in a primary, has now worked out a way with his colleagues in the legislature to basically rid us of the Working Families Party by making it obnoxiously hard to get onto the ballot, much harder than it was. We've talked about this several times, you and I. Anything new?
Well, I mean, this is one of the big elections for minor parties. I mean, you're right, the Working Families Party has a struggle, but all of them do. The Independence Party does, the Green Party, the Conservative Party. They all have to meet new thresholds, and one of them is they have to meet a voter. They have to have a certain number of ballots cast on their line in this election. So, for example, if someone supported the Working Families Party, since you brought them up as an example, and they voted on they voted for Joe Biden, let's say, on that line, that counts toward the number of votes they need in a presidential year. I believe it's about 130 votes. That counts toward their sort of political strength, which keeps them on the voter registration forms and gives them an automatic ballot status. But if they don't get that, then they're just like any other minor party that does not have that. They're going to have to search for votes in the future to continue to have their strength. So I think it's going to be really an open question as to whether or not any of the political parties, minor political parties, can meet that threshold. Conservative Party probably has the best chance, but all of them are facing this problem. And it is, you're absolutely right, it's a new and much higher hurdle for minor parties to reach to have permanent ballot status.
Blair Horner, let's talk a little bit about the budget deficit. Now, we know that Andrew Cuomo was playing his cards very close to his vest. And he was saying all along, I'm not going to consider how we're going to make this budget work because we're going to be $30 billion in the hole this year and next. And I'm not going to give you a plan B. I'm waiting for the federal money to come. Well, he's keeping waiting. It's like a kid who says, I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to keep my breath in. I'm not going to breathe. You're not hurting anybody else. You're hurting you. But of course, he has to have had a plan B, and schools and police departments and social service agencies are in real trouble, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, the legislature granted the governor enormous powers, new powers, as part of the budget deal earlier this year, both to change the budget unilaterally and also to enact laws unilaterally. It's a huge shift in the power of government from the legislative branch to the executive branch in ways that really runs afoul of what our founding fathers thought about. They wanted a sort of a system where the two branches of government, all three branches of government, actually could keep a check on each other. The legislature's largely given that power up to the executive in this case. It's to make an argument, it was a good idea. But right now, under that deal, the governor could make unilateral cuts, but had to alert the legislature when he did so that they would have 10 days to make any changes to what the governor's proposed. So the governor's strategy is to withhold funding and argue that he's going to withhold it until he sees what the feds do. And until then, the feds will, and if the feds never act, the withholds go in place. So there are lots of not-for-profits that are facing closure. The public higher education institutions are facing a $500 million cut in their funding from the state. I mean, there's all sorts of problems all across the state that are going to, that are manifesting themselves effectively as cuts. And until the feds act, that's what the governor's strategy is, a combination of borrowing and withholding funding from local governments and various state institutions.
Well, even if he withholds 20%, I don't see how he comes up with $30 billion.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, I think that the play for them would be to see if they can kick the can through the election, which they've successfully done. And then see what happens if there's going to be a new Congress with a Senate Majority Leader Schumer and a president named Biden, and hope that the feds will come through next year. Now, even if the Congress, even if those things happen, it's not like there's going to be action in the first 30 days of a Biden administration. But we'll see. I mean, the next year, I think they're going to try to kick the can into next calendar year, depending on the outcome of the election, and hope that they can sort of maintain a, you know, scotch tape and glue approach to the budget and hope that the feds bail them out in early 2021.
What about the idea that the people at the bottom are the people who get help the most? In other words, Blair, there's a certain amount of money that goes to the people who have the least. And that's the kind of griping you hear from people who don't like paying taxes. Not only that, then you get the legislative leaders jumping on, taking the easy way out and saying, okay, tax the rich. There's a nice bundle for you to dissemble for us.
Well, I think there is a legitimate argument, and there always will be because government is run by human beings. There's always going to be a legitimate argument that you need to reform the government to make it more efficient. And unfortunately, that's never the argument that gets made by people in government. They just say, okay, we'll do a 20% across the board cut, and you guys figure it out. And what happens is people protect their bureaucracies as best they can under those circumstances. And that's understandable. But the governor who, this governor who ran in 2010 saying he was going to reform government in the first, in the way that Al Smith did in 1919, has not done that yet. And I think it's important to combine whatever they ultimately come up with a real serious reform of how the government operates, coupled with taxation that meets the goals of government. And that has to happen at the federal level, too. You can't run around and have debt levels at post-World War II levels and not increase tax rates to pay for it. You just can't sustain it that way. And so we have to have a real conversation in the country about the price of civilization and the need for the best government we can afford.
Talk to me a little about the stock transfer tax. Seems like a good way to do it. You could get an awful lot of money that way. But the governor seems hesitant, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, well, the, just so your listeners know, I mean, there's on the books since 1905 a tax in New York on the sale and purchase of stocks. And it's like a sales tax. It's like when you pay to buy a pair of shoes. And so New York has stopped collecting it, keeping it. But the tax is still on the books. And so if New York collected it, they'd probably raise somewhere upwards around $10 billion for this fiscal year. And that could go a long way toward balancing the budget. The concern the governor has is Wall Street rattles its saber and says, well, we're going to leave if you do that. I think legal scholars would argue that the state still has the authority to collect the tax, even if they did, because Wall Street likes, those people like to live in Manhattan. But you could still collect the tax. But nevertheless, I think that's what the concern is. It's like taking on oil companies in Texas when you take on Wall Street in New York. But the state needs the money. And if the alternative is cutting K-12 education in all the school districts across the state by 20% or collecting one quarter of the collecting like 25 cents on the sale of $100 in stock, I think New Yorkers would say, well, let's collect the sales tax and not have those cuts.
Let me talk to you about your real specialty, which you really are good at, as well as everything else. But higher education. You know, I've been thinking about this a lot as a guy who taught at a state university for 40 years, that we may end up with very few private or independent colleges in New York State because of this mess that we're in right now. There have been all kinds of analysis that says several of our most prestigious places are faced with going under. We've talked about this before, but I'm wondering what you're seeing.
Well, I mean, it's across the board problem in higher education. The community colleges and the state university are hemorrhaging finances. And the governor recently just put out a change in regulation, which I think will further diminish the state's support for community colleges. So it really is about upstate schools to some extent versus downstate schools, private and public. And the big question really will be in New York is, what kind of higher education system do we want to have? If we want to have a system that allows both opportunities in public education and independent education, then the state is going to have to provide support to make that happen. A lot of these smaller upstate liberal colleges are in real trouble financially, and it's not gotten any better as the state withholds $500 million in support for all sorts of institutions in higher education. And what's the community colleges in upstate are taking a pounding. They have a combination of declining enrollment because of declining population between 18 to 24 in particular. And to offset that, they have to keep raising public college tuition at community colleges, which further makes it less affordable for the people who do live there. And so the state really needs to have, this goes back to my earlier point, need to have some sort of like global look at, well, what are we trying to do with higher education? It's a critical service that's provided because the 21st century is all about high-end knowledge. It's a critical service that's provided. How are we going to deliver it? Because the way they're doing it now is just torpedoing the schools that have the least least public support. And that may not be the strategy that makes the most sense.
Mm. Let me ask you about the two-party system in New York State, the Republican Party. Somebody wisely said years ago that they're on the ropes. They're really on the ropes. They did elect a Republican governor for 3 terms, George Pataki, but it hasn't gone well for them, and they really haven't been able to come up with really high-powered gubernatorial candidates who could run against Cuomo. Do you think they're done?
Well, I think Republicans in the Northeast have a real problem. I mean, you look anywhere north and east of Pennsylvania, and it's hard to find Republicans that get elected to office. We'll see how Susan Collins does in a week, but she's on the ropes. And, you know, the whole system is changing. As the elections in the United States became nationalized, the more Northeast moderate Republicans have really taken a beating because they have hung around their neck the conservative policies of George W. Bush and Donald T. Trump and J. Trump. And so all of those, they're sort of running against the tide. And it's very hard to swim with a cinder block around your neck. And that's effectively what's happened. I mean, there will always be conservative pockets in the Northeast, and they'll elect the members of Congress. But if you look at the delegations, you know, north and east of Pennsylvania, it is really hard to find, and it will be my prediction will be it'll be fewer of them come election day in a week.
You know, that's extraordinary because every once in a while, a Governor Baker in Massachusetts or Governor Pataki in New York gets elected. Is that because voters are just holding their noses and saying, enough of this, we've got to make a change, and this is what's available right now? And you get governors who become what I have always called Republicrats.
Remember, Pataki last got elected almost 20 years ago, so it's a long time that the Republicans have been able to pull off a statewide election in New York. And you do have Governor Baker, for example, in Massachusetts. I think there will always be the Bloomberg-style Republicans that may emerge and challenge unpopular incumbents or advance reformist agendas or come up with a message that runs counter to one-party rule. I mean, one-party rule has its own problems, too, in terms of the political party that's in power, just sort of looking out for its own interest, even at the expense of the public interest. And so I think that will always happen, but it's just much, much, much harder. The climb is very steep, and the same problem the Democrats face in the Deep South. where you basically have they're out of sync with the nationalization of elections. Or California, I mean, when was the last time a statewide elected official got elected there that was a Republican? It was Schwarzenegger. And, you know, he's unique in terms of his ability to run. So it will still happen, but it's going to be in increasingly rare circumstances, I predict.
Okay. So as a college professor in political science classes, there's always somebody who said, why don't we have initiative and referendum in New York State? Why?
Well, I mean, maybe we should. I mean, you do have initiative and referendum at the local government level. You just don't have them at the state level. The big problem is you can't enact meaningful regulation of initiative and referendum when it comes to the spending in support or in opposition to a particular question. And so, I mean, New York has a version of referenda where New Yorkers can vote on increases in debt, for example. Those get put on the ballot, or changes in the Constitution that comes from the legislature. But we don't have a citizen-initiated referenda at the state level. And, other states have it. It's a mechanism for the public to express its interest. So, that's a good thing. The problem is the system's awash in big money at every level, and you'd have that same problem even with an initiative.
Yeah, that's true. I'm all for it, by the way, Blair, and I'm willing to take
it. So am I.
You know, I think people should have that choice. We have it in Massachusetts, where I live, and it works pretty well. California, which you raised, doesn't always work well. Some of the big boys put some propositions up which can be hurtful. But in any case, Blair Horner, we love having you on the Capital Connection because you're so smart. And it is a great moment for us when we can achieve the rare acquiescence of you to be on the show. So we're out of time. Our guest has been Blair Horner, the executive director of NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group. Blair, we look forward to the next time you're on explaining it all to us. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me, and everyone should support WAMC.